up, fools? This is a QTR podcast. Today is March 28th, 2020. This podcast, like all my podcasts, is brought to you by my patrons. Patrons are people who sign up online and donate a monthly recurring sum to help support the podcast. I'm going to shout out some of my patrons. I'll give you the two rules for today's podcast, and then we're going to get the damn show on the road. First and foremost, this podcast is brought to you by my friends over at the Sanlucci Steam Room. Sanlucci and Charlie Bathgate run the Steam Room. What is it? It is an online, live, daily options chat room that basically is going to show you where the money is coming into the options market. Why is that important? It's important because oftentimes money coming into the options market can precede moves in the equities market. Nobody knows more about this and nobody can communicate it better than my homeboy Sanlucci and his brother Charlie Bathgate over at the Sanlucci Steam Room. They've been doing it for a decade. They are honest guys. They're some of the smartest people that I know. Sanlucci is a regular on the podcast. Just a great guy. Also, in addition to that, they offer the 3LT playbook, which are Lucci's three rules that he used to become a millionaire. I've seen the P&L. I've seen the bank statements, folks. It's not bullshit. And also the Sanlucci Master Course, which is tape reading, market psychology, all of the things that they're experts in, broken down into regular person talk. All the links to those things are in my podcast description. Check out my brothers over at the Sanlucci Steam Room. This podcast also brought to you by my very good friend Pete Hedges over at the Trader's Path. If you're looking for a community of traders, if you're a day trader, especially now with the market going haywire, and you're looking for a community, and you're looking for a spot to go where you know they're not going to take advantage of you, they're not just going to take your money and run, where they actually have your best interest at heart and sharing ideas, they're not going to front run your trades, they're not going to feed you a lot of bullshit. That's why my man Pete started the Trader's Path. The Trader's Path offers daily watch lists. It offers live streams also on the daily of what they're doing. So you'll be getting ideas. You'll have people to bounce these ideas off of. Investor education. There's a ton of information. It's daily. It's live. It's like having a great community. And right now, since we're social distancing, you can't be around people anyway. So it's no better time to check out the Trader's Path and engage in a community online while you're trading because you're a terrible trader. I wanted to tell you, I didn't want to have to say it, I didn't want to talk any shit, but you're a terrible trader and you know it. So surround yourself with some other people and start to turn your shit around, will you? Check out my good friend Pete Hedges over at the Trader's Path. There is a link to him in the podcast description as well. This podcast also brought to you by my longtime supporters over at rumorhound.ai. Love these guys and love Rumorhound. Rumorhound is a one-of-a-kind piece of software that takes a look at merger and acquisition rumors as they happen. And you know, if you're a trader, they happen daily. They happen on Twitter, on CNBC. They come across various news networks. And the trick oftentimes is trying to confirm whether or not they are legit or not. Money can be made and money can be lost. Rumorhound is a unique tool that uses a proprietary artificial intelligence-based algorithm to take a bunch of variables when a rumor hits the wire and then spit out to you a recommendation as to whether or not the rumor is something that you might want to pay attention to or something that you might want to ignore. It is a beautiful platform, it's nice to look at, and it's another wonderful tool to have in your day trading arsenal. My friends at the Trader's Path, the Sanlucci Steam Room, and Rumorhound, these tools can pay for themselves if you use them the right way in a very short period of time. So check them out, especially if you're a day trader. Links to all three are in the podcast description. This podcast also brought to you by my friends at Corvus Gold, my good friend Monero, my buddy Jay Mintzmyer, who is a fantastic shipping analyst, my buddy Russ Valenti, Nicholas Parks, Nathan Michaud at Investors Underground and Traders for a Cause, my longtime supporter Chris Bede has been with me almost 2 years. Thanks so much, Chris. Ken R. has also been with me for almost 2 years. Thank you, Ken R. Chris Boas has also been with me for almost 2 years. Thank you, Chris Boas. Crichton Titus, Dylan Davis, my homeboy, Ken, J.K. Cunningham, Stank Love is still in the house. So is Brainerd Ferguson, and also some of my newest patrons, people that have recently signed up to help support the podcast. My friend Grant Black, what's up? Just signed up. Yesterday. Thank you, my man. John Edwards, John Longobardi is here. Toby Wilson, Robert Thrash, thank you, my friend. Tracy Connors, my homeboy Nick Bradley is in the house. Vaclav Kosar, Kemen Lin Swain, Mecha Troner is in the house. Alejandro Yankelevich, Kent, Thomas Cravey, Michael Flowers, and James Malloy. What's going on? Awesome to see everybody. Thank you guys so much. Now, two rules for the podcast. First and foremost, every single podcast I have ever done, going back to 180-something podcasts, there has been a required two-drink minimum. The way that it works is you fill up your glass with whatever you like, and then you drink it, and then you listen to the podcast. It's very easy. It's very simple. A caveman could do it, folks. There's nothing to it. All you got to do is get drunk. I'm not asking for anything. You don't even have to get drunk. For most of you guys, probably takes more than two to get drunk anyways. Point is, have a couple of drinks and relax while you're listening, okay? So with the world fucking on fire and Rome burning in the background, just sip your little martini and put on some QTR podcast and pretend like everything's going all right for an hour or 2 hours here while we're on the podcast. Then you can go back to the world burning down when you're done. Also, I am not a financial advisor. This is not financial advice. My guests are not financial advisors. They don't give financial advice. I hold no registrations. I hold no licenses. None of that. None of this is investment advice. Do your research elsewhere. Don't talk to me about your trading. I don't care. And if you sent me a DM and I haven't responded, it's not because I don't want to. It's because I have hundreds of them that I haven't gotten back to. So this is my blanket apology for all those. Sorry. Thank you for all the good shit in the DMs. I appreciate it. But I'm only one man and I can't get back to all of them. All right. With me today is one of the guys that I like listening to the most, the host of the Rebel Capitalist show on YouTube. He's got like almost 100,000 YouTube subscribers now. Why? Because he uses his brain and applies common sense to finance. I know that's crazy in this day and age, but that's what he's done, and there is obviously a huge audience for it. He has become hugely popular over the last couple of months. Mr. George Gammon, how are you today, sir?
I'm doing real well, Chris. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Dude, I'm stoked that you're here. And what people don't know is that we just did a show on your show a couple of days ago, which will be up this week. And I felt so bad because I was talking so much throughout that interview that I was like, you got to come back on my show so that I can hear what you have to say, too.
No, you know, well, how it is, you know this, most people probably wouldn't, but you've got to be under a different mindset depending on whether you're the person asking the questions, doing the interview, or you're the person being interviewed. And I'm so new to the game, and I've very little experience doing this, so I've got to be cognizant of that and hopefully not talk more than the person that I'm interviewing or vice versa.
Yeah, there's definitely an art form to it that I had to kind of learn along the way. I still talk too much.
Yeah, so do I.
But I tune in and listen to your stuff all the time. And so to be on your show, I find myself wondering what you're thinking and wondering why I'm talking so much. So I'm really glad that you're on here. And congrats with your channel, by the way. It's kicking major ass.
I appreciate it. It's shocking. It's kind of like having a tiger by the tail. But it's a lot of fun, and especially during these times, I think it's extremely important that people in the general public have some good information and some good aggregated information. I don't want to say that I'm the one thinking of all the concepts and ideas that I talk about on the channel. Far from it. But it's guys that you and I have a lot of respect for, a lot of the people you'd see on Macro Voices or Real Vision or Shift, or any of those guys that kind of lean more Austrian.
Yeah, so let's talk about a couple of things. I want to talk about the whole shit show as it's happening here.
Yeah.
But I want to start by just talking about the coronavirus. Last time you were on was February 13th. The coronavirus was not anywhere near as big of a deal as it is now. What I'd like first is your thoughts on the virus, X its economic impact, which we will get into. Talk to me about what George Gammon thinks about, the virus, its global reach, and just in general.
What I've been trying to sort out the last few days in my mind is, how do you tackle this? And is it a problem that we have any control over whatsoever? And here's what I mean by that. let's just assume, and I can't think of a different alternative. I hope I'm wrong. But the only way that this plays out through a society or globally is either you get to herd immunity, and I'm happy to explain that, or you get to a point where we have a vaccine, right, which is basically right, the same thing. Now, if the R-naught value, and that's how fast it spreads, is at a 3, which is kind of the general consensus. I've read a lot of reports saying that it could be higher than that. But if it's a 3, then your herd immunity for a population is 60%. So 60% of the people have to be infected before this thing kind of plays out, right? Well, that would be roughly 190 million Americans, okay? Well, let's just say that it's got the same type of case fatality rate as what we've seen on the Princess cruise ship. I forgot the name of it. And that was right around that. Most people think that's the best example, kind of contained data that we have. That would be around 1%. Okay. Well, that means even if the hospital capacity within the United States could scale at the same rate, you're looking at right around 1.9 million people losing their lives as a result. And you say, well, George, what we can contain everyone. We can quarantine. We can do social distancing. We can do face masks. We can do all these other ways to kind of address the problem. That's fine. But you're not reducing it. The only thing you're doing is slowing it down. Right. It has to go through 1.9 million people in order for it to play out, unless we get a vaccine. Now, obviously, it's optimal to have it go through a lot fewer people and bias time. You know, let's say a vaccine is 12 months away. If you look at it that way and it starts to dawn on you that you're between a rock and a hard place in the sense that even if you do quarantine everyone to reduce the health impact, it's still spreading. And it's still going to spread until it gets to those numbers. It's just going to spread more slowly. And the more you quarantine people, the more you have it in the system and the longer it takes to get to the herd immunity. So if you could just wave a magic wand, and I know this is impossible because we're all emotional creatures and whatnot, but let's just say that the data came back and we had thorough enough data that we could determine without a doubt that this really was only a problem for those 55 and older. And I'm not saying that it is. I'm not saying that young people are immune. I'm just creating a hypothetical scenario right here. And of course, we don't have the data because we are stupid and we didn't test right from the get-go. But assuming we did, then you could, I think you could say, all right, we can just quarantine the people that are 55 and older, assuming people 54 and younger make up at least 60% of the population, and let's just say it doesn't affect them at all other than they just get sick. Well, then you could have a scenario where they're the sacrificial lamb, if you will, and they go out into the community, they go back to driving their Uber, the Starbucks, going to college, doing whatever it is they do, just living kind of a normal life. And then you quarantine all those 55 and older, and you allow it to work its way through the population that's actually healthy, and then hopefully it gets up 100% of those people get it. So then you're at 60%, and then you kind of let the other people that were higher risk out back into normal everyday life. Now, I understand that's looking at like it's a board game, and that's totally unrealistic, but that, if you ask me what I'm thinking about, that's what I've been thinking about the last couple of days on just basically how could you tackle this if you had total control?
Yeah, we really are stuck between a rock and a hard place because I wrote an article this morning, and one of the things that I talked about in it was if we know that this was around in Wuhan in November, which they know. Right, China has traced a case back to November 17th, I think. Yeah. Now, I'm not even going to discount that because it's the Chinese government. I'd say probably earlier than that, but let's just go with that. And with all of the flights going back and forth, in and out of all the international airports, to and from all the airports in China and to and from all over the world, especially throughout the holidays. Do you think at all in your brain, is there a case for, hey, this thing is everywhere already, and really what the testing is not uncovering it in real time, but rather just picking up cases that have been being passed around for months now already? How far behind the eight ball do you think we are?
We're completely behind the eight ball. I mean, even if you look at countries like Singapore or South Korea, that most would argue they addressed it the right way, and that's doing as much testing and isolating as you possibly can right now, to where it number one, has a reduced strain on the hospital system, number two, doesn't totally cripple your economy. But still, they're left in a huge dilemma, in the sense that, what do you just completely cut off international flights? Because, okay, great, you tackled it and you flattened out the curve in your country. Well, who's to say that there's not going to be a airplane load of people from New York that are flying into Singapore to go to the Marina Bay Sands, and then bam, all of a sudden you got the same exact problem all over again. So there's so many layers to this. But yes, I do think, to answer your question, that it could be much more prevalent. And I wish there was an outcome where we could already be at herd immunity, and it's just such a mild virus, in the sense that, let's say, 50% of Americans have been affected by this and don't even know it, and therefore the numbers that we're seeing are going to hopefully peak out very soon. I would love to have that type of optimism. The problem with that is, whenever they do aggressive testing, and they, like in New York or other places around the world, they don't find that 90% of the people that they test have it. They only find that, let's say, 5% or 10%. And people say, oh, well, that's great because only 5% of the people have it. No, that's actually really bad, because you would actually want a lot more people to have it and not have gone to the hospital, right, to where you're building up that herd immunity faster. So I think, to answer your question directly, yes, I definitely think it could be more prevalent throughout society, but I don't know that that's a panacea.
Well, it's extremely difficult for us to be able to pinpoint where we are unless we get testing data,
right,
from the entire country. I mean, the only way to know exactly how far this virus has run its course in our country, now that the flights are stopped, now that we are doing all of these social distancing measures and everything that we've done now, the only way to do it is to test ubiquitously. And Trump said the other day, you know, I don't know what the point of testing the whole country is. The point of testing the whole country is so you get the news, whether the news is 90% of the country already has it, or right, the news is 20% of the country has it, because it's only then you can kind of distinguish which of the, you know, responses is the lesser of the evils, right? Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. And more importantly, you can determine who really is at high risk. I mean, throughout the media, we've heard that, well, it's just old people. Well, I hope it's just one subset, but it could be the elderly. It could be people with diabetes. It could be people who smoke, people who are overweight, males. I've read some reports saying that males are much more at risk than females. We just don't know. And if you are able to test a huge group of people and then have really smart scientists that know this stuff really crunch the numbers, then they could come out with hopefully some peer-reviewed data that would say, listen, okay, this group of people is at very high risk. This group of people is at no more risk than a common cold or the flu. Okay, well, if we know that definitively, and right now we don't, then you could take measures to quarantine those people who are most at risk and let the other people build up the herd immunity for those people that are stuck at home, assuming assuming that the subset of people that were at low risk actually made up at least 60%. And then also keep in mind, Chris, that as the R-naught value goes up, so does the herd immunity, or the percentage of the population that has to actually get the virus,
yeah, the threshold,
in order,
right,
to achieve that level of herd immunity. So if it's, you know, if it's 3, then that means that you're at a 60% rate of the population. That's the percentage of the population that needs to get it. If you're at, let's say, a 4 or 5, it could go up to 80% or so. And see, that's a bogey as well. You don't really know what it is, again, because we haven't done the amount of testing required.
So if George Gammon is the president, what does George Gammon do for the United States?
Oh, my gosh. Test. I would test. I would get the smartest scientists that I possibly could to test as many people and collect the data, crunch the numbers, and just as close to real time as possible, give me the information, not me, me and the team of experts that I have, get us the data so we can determine what the smartest approach is to not only minimize the health damage that this does to our society, but also the economic damage, everything combined. But then there's also this teeter-totter that I went over this in my video on Saturday, where it is a give and take, and there's no solutions. There's only alternatives, unfortunately, that in order to have optimal health, you've got to potentially put the United States into a 1930s-type depression. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a deflationary depression. Let's keep in mind, it very well could be an inflationary depression. And I don't think most people even talk about that, other than Schiff. Schiff talks about it all the time. But and also with inflation, who knows what the price of, or who knows what the personal CPI is? Like, your CPI could be different than mine. It could be different than a school teacher's. It could be different than, a hedge fund manager's. And my concern is that the average citizen and the average household making 65 grand a year, that their inflation rate could go through the roof, while at the same time their wages stay the same, and asset prices, especially like their house, which would be probably the majority of their net worth along with their 401k, that goes into deflation, a debt deflation. So that's, you know, you got that on one side. And then on the other side, you say, well, let's let it rip through the society to save, quote unquote, save the economy. And there you just get millions, potentially millions of people that die. But it doesn't necessarily save the economy. I think most people need to understand that even from an economic standpoint, even the most optimistic outlook, you're not going back to where we were 2 months ago. Right. Like that ship has sailed. We're not going back there. And I was just on another show before this, and they asked me a question about, well, if Trump lifts the whatever, this faux quasi quarantine or whatever, and has everyone go back to work Easter, well, isn't that a game changer? Well, I don't know. I mean, is it? Especially since you've been watching the numbers in the United States, we're now, if you believe China's numbers, we're now leading the world in cases, and it's not like the curve is flattening. If you look at our growth curve on the John Hopkins website for the United States, Chris, it's almost vertical. And I realize that we're doing more testing and whatnot, but the bottom line is people going out and going to restaurants and taking vacations and getting on a plane and doing all these things that we were doing as of 30 days ago, that's all psychological. That doesn't really have to do with corporations having liquidity and being backstopped by the Fed. So let's just say that Nike or Starbucks says, okay, you know, we got this, the Fed's bought all of our garbage debt, or not that their debt is garbage, but you know, you just fill in the blank with any corporation you want to choose. And Trump says we can open up our doors and great, let's do it. Everyone back to work. Okay, Well, just because the corporations go back to work, it doesn't necessarily mean that the customers go back to work. And I understand that a lot of people will, but there's going to be a large amount of people that don't. And the longer this plays out, and the worse the numbers get, and the more the media picks it up, the deeper the cut is, the deeper the psychological cut is going to be. Therefore, the bigger the scar is going to be, and the longer it's going to take from a psychological standpoint, from a society, to actually, quote unquote, recover. I also think that what most people are missing, or maybe not, they haven't really thought this far ahead, but what happens even if this does work its way through the through society from a health standpoint? And obviously some states are going to get it a lot worse than others, and then some countries are going to get a lot worse than others. Well, okay, so do we now ban all flights coming in from countries where this is worse than the United States? Do we quarantine those people for, let's say, 14 days? And let's say that you're a Montana and you're looking at New York, where it, and let's just say in 2 or 3 weeks' time it's gotten far worse. Obviously, we hope it doesn't, but let's just say that it does. It stays on the current exponential curve. Well, is Montana going to quarantine all flights coming in from New York or California? I mean, how is this really going to play out? And then, and that's in a best case scenario where we can, everyone's willing to get back on a plane and do all these things. There's just so many unknowns, and this is just uncharted waters, not only from a health standpoint, but an economic standpoint. For those people that I watch on CNBC or on Twitter or in the comments of maybe not my YouTube videos, but more mainstream financial channels, YouTube videos, that are seeing this as this V-shaped recovery. And they're only thinking that, well, this is just some freak black swan. And as soon as the Fed steps in like they have and the government spends $2 trillion, as soon as that starts working its way through the economy, we're right back to where we were. Dow 30,000, we're back to the races. I really don't think they're really understanding how the market and how this is going to play out. Also, one more thing I'd like to add to that is when you have a market that's psychologically been impacted like this, a lot of people, well, actually, we have recency bias, right? And so for a lot of these investors that have never really lived through a crash and they don't understand this, they want to rationalize how things are playing out. So I think that when you have this type of recovery like we did last week, or this big jump in the Dow for a few days straight, then all these investors that might not have as much experience, they're on the way down. They're saying, oh, well, all the bad news for the coronavirus is baked into the system, right? That's already factored into the price. When then on the way up, when we get to a peak, they're not saying the same thing about the $700 billion of quantitative easing and $125 billion a day and the $1 trillion of commitment in repo, the $2 trillion in stimulus package. So let's say now that that's baked into the price of the S&P. We had a 900-point down day on Friday. So now what's left? What's the ammo? And then also, you know, I haven't done the math on this, but one thing I think is very interesting is if the Fed continues to buy $125 billion a day, and let's just say they're buying treasuries, well, just back of the napkin math, that takes us to $45 trillion. The balance sheet would be of the Fed after 365 days, assuming, you know, they didn't take weekends off or whatever. And sure, they take holidays off, but they're going to peg the yield curve as well. So let's call it a straight $45 billion. And let's just assume the only way they can print money or expand their balance sheet is by buying assets. Well, if they're just buying treasury, and I'm not saying they are, but it's just kind of a fun thought experiment to say, well, at what point do you run out of treasuries? Like, there's only $23 trillion in debt, so that'll last the Fed for about 6 months. And then could you get into this, like psychotic situation where the Fed could no longer print money because they don't have any more assets to buy. Do you think we get there?
Well, I put out a tweet last week. I said the Fed's going to buy the whole bond market.
Yeah, and, there you go.
You know, I was saying it kind of in jest, but also certainly looks like the direction we're heading in, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how they can stop buying assets. And I thought they were doing it prior to even announcing it, just through the primary dealer credit facility that they set up. You know, that to me is just kind of a ruse, where I know they're technically they're just allowing those primary dealers to offer any type of collateral they want, including equities, in more like a repo transaction, where it's technically kind of a loan, where it goes onto the Fed's balance sheet, the primary dealer gets the cash, but then they swap back the next day. But I think we talked about this the other day, where, I mean, if the Fed is lending them money for, let's call it 90 days at 0% interest, and they can continually roll it over, is that really a loan? And I thought, just being more conspiratorial, that what if the Fed is just saying to the primary dealers, calling up, say, hey guys, we really need to have a Fed put here, or we really need the plunge protection team to come in. So why don't you guys take the $1.5 trillion that you have in reserves, excess reserves here at the Fed, why don't you go into the market, buy the corporate debt, buy the stocks, and then we'll take them off your balance sheet as a repo type transaction in this primary dealer credit facility type thing. So then technically the Fed's buying these stocks and other assets, but they're doing it through the primary dealers. Then they came out and just said, well, we'll screw that. We're just going to go directly into the credit markets and buy corporate debt ourselves and forget about the Federal Reserve Act. But I thought even before that, it was kind of a roundabout way to get the same job done.
Yeah, so let's go back, because I do want to talk about economics in a minute, but I want to kind of unpack this slowly. Let's go back to what you were saying about whether or not life is going to change as a result of this. Now, what you were saying earlier is, oh, there's all these guys on CNBC saying we're going to have this V-shaped recovery and that one day we're going to wake up and things are going to be different. And the way that I see that is that may be the case once we get a vaccine, which is 12 to 18 months out right now. But until then, and we don't know, it may not be the case, depending on what the hell has happened between now and then. But certainly until then, let's talk about 12 months, 18 months. Life is going to be very different. Even if Trump reopens the nation, which it looks like he isn't going to do. He's coming out today and he's saying, well, maybe I'll actually quarantine New York and do an enforceable quarantine of Connecticut and things like that. So I think his scientific advisors, hopefully, my fingers are crossed, have his ear. But even if he does that, let's say this fades over the summer a little bit, George.
Yeah.
And then heading into the fall, you know, we decide to implement partially, you know, some of the things that you've suggested, where, you know, maybe we're opening up select areas, or we're letting select people out, or the people we know that we're immune or whatever.
Well, and to be clear, Chris, I'm not suggesting that.
Sure, sure.
By no means am I suggesting that. I'm just saying that's what I've been thinking about. I've been trying to just, you know, in my own mind, try to work out how that may work and if it is even an option. But I'm not saying that's the best way to tackle it.
Right. I'm sorry. And I misspoke. I just meant to say that you had brought it up. I mean, how is life different in general just over the next 12 to 18 months? I mean, this, you talked a little bit about the psychological impact. I think there's going to be a lot of PTSD from this, and I don't think we go back to normal ever. Do you feel the same way?
I just think it's a new normal, and maybe that's your point. Well, until we get the vaccine, I think that changes things quite a bit. But assuming that we haven't received that vaccine and people start to wake up to the fact that this is – that we're not going to defuse the situation or the risk until we get to that herd immunity, And let's say things do open back up, I think you're just going to see a lot fewer people going to restaurants, a lot fewer people going to movie theaters, any places where there's a lot of congestion. I think you're going to see the United States look a lot, and Europe look a lot more like Asia, in the sense that whenever you go to the airport, 90% of the people are wearing N95 masks. And it's just a lot more people are going through the drive-through, just these little subtle changes. But I think just the biggest change from a visual standpoint is going to be just everyone walking around with gloves and a mask when you go to Costco.
Yeah, and you're already seeing that. And not only are you seeing it in major cities, but in suburbia and rural areas that I've been to, where I've gone out to, you know, little podunk markets, that is the norm. And I'm not talking about, you know, people in LA and New York City that are, you know, it's the new norm. It seems to be widely adopted now that that's the norm.
Absolutely. And I think that there's going to be a push in for younger people to want, I think they still want to live in the city, but I think they want to maybe try to find something close to the city that's got at least a little bit of a backyard to where they could grow some of their own vegetables. I mean, and I know it really hasn't gotten this far in the United States, but let me tell you, I've been quarantined in Medellin, Colombia for the last 7 days, almost 8 days now, where I literally haven't stepped foot out of my apartment. You're not allowed to. And it sucks. I mean, it really, really sucks. And you can sit there prior to, and even if you're trying to stay home a lot, but you're still going out jogging and you're going for a walk and walking the dog, going to the grocery store, and you'd be like, yeah, it might give me some time to learn Spanish or something like that. Yeah, no, you don't get it. Seriously, you don't get it. Wait till you have to spend 2 or 3 weeks straight in your house, literally without stepping out the front door. You've got a whole new appreciation for exactly what you're saying. But my point is, I mean, I haven't even eaten a vegetable for a week straight. It's just canned food, like you're living in a cave. It's like prepper. It's like watching the prepper TV show or something. And it really sucks. It really is brutal. But my point is, you know, even if this lifts in Colombia after a month or two or whatever it is, and I can only imagine how I'll feel in another 2 or 3 weeks. If I already feel this way after 1 week, then I mean, I think even I'm going to be looking at maybe buying a piece of property up in the mountains, or not the mountains, but, you know, 45 minutes out of town. That's just kind of a little reprieve where if it hits the fan again, you always have that. You've always got a little place to grow your own stuff. And trust me, I'm as skeptical about the government as anyone else, and I'm a libertarian just like you are. But I wasn't really huge into building like an underground bunker and whatnot, and I'm probably not there yet, but I am leaning more towards just having a nice little piece of property out in the middle of nowhere that you can go to and get away from the insanity if something like this were to hit again. So if I'm feeling that way, think about how many other Americans will feel that way after they've been locked up in their house and they literally cannot leave for, call it, a month or 6 weeks.
Yeah, sure. And that's where you want to be, right? Somebody was just saying, I forget if it was on another podcast, it may have been on Joe Rogan, but somebody was just talking about people that live in the country and how they do all their own shit. When you live in the country and you got 10 acres between you and your neighbor, you have to take care of your own shit. You grow your own food, you fix your own truck. That, you know, the, something falls off the fucking house, you go out there and bolt it back on.
Yeah.
And you're not calling the plumber every time the toilet gets clogged up. There's something to be said for that, right? There's something to be said for that kind of autonomy where, and especially like you're saying, if you have a large plot of land and maybe you're houses recessed a quarter mile off the road, nobody can tell you to come and not step out on your porch. That's private property at that point, you know?
Yeah, and you could get out of the house. You could jog. I mean, I'm just thinking, I'm in my apartment's about 2,000 square feet. I can't even imagine if I had
it's
just
bigger than my house.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, you could go out jogging, you could exercise, you could do all that stuff. And you know what's really interesting, Chris, is I think we're going to move into an economic environment where people are much more focused on the basics than just trying to get rich by buying Tesla stock. Right. Or it's less of a financialized economy. So they're more worried about what I'm calling, as of last week on my videos, just food, energy, and shelter. And notice I said shelter and I didn't say real estate or housing. I'm starting to compartmentalize those two things. And unfortunately, I think people's 401k, it's going to take a big hit. I think their earning power is going to take a big hit. We might go through this stagflation or inflationary depression that we talked about earlier, and people's purchasing power is going to be, well, I think it's going to come down a lot, even from what it has been the last, call it decade, when real wages really haven't gone up that much. So you're going to be able to buy a lot less. And I hate to say that. I struggle to even say that because I try to be an optimist. But I think that's going to be the reality of for most Americans, because our economy was so financialized and we had so much of our net worth in assets that required a tremendous amount of debt. And that's stocks, housing, corporate bonds, etc. So the good news is if you look at a lot of rural areas in the United States and in Europe, I actually talked to Mark Faber about this on our interview the other day, and there's some really cheap real estate, like super cheap. And I think what's really cool, well, not cool, but what's having to stay at home and work like we are right now and like most people in the world will have to over the next couple months, hopefully it'll open people's eyes up to the reality that, hey, maybe I can do more at home. Maybe I don't have to be in a city center. And then maybe you start looking out into some of these rural areas and the cost of living is a lot cheaper out there and you can work from home. You just need an internet connection. So maybe it's a transition into something where there's a lot more opportunity and a better way of life and a way to expand your purchasing power is right there in front of us. And hopefully it'll present itself. And that's me trying to look at the glass half full.
Do you, when, you know, you mentioned earlier about the U.S. surpassing China in terms of infections. And this is something I wrote about today. There's a lot of people pointing the finger at the U.S. and saying, hey, you guys really dropped the ball here. These numbers are skyrocketing. I posted a chart of, like you said, the number of infections is going vertical right now in the U.S. Relative to what the line from China looks like, where it did go vertical and then it plateaued. But the U.S. data only looks terrible if you believe the Chinese data. And I wanted to ask you two things. One is, do you believe the data coming out of China? And then two, why do you think so many mainstream media news outlets, and today while I was researching my piece, CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, Bloomberg, a bunch of outlets online, the New York Times, take China's data at face value. They immediately, and they use it as the basis for their models and for their articles. It's an assumed truth by them. You think that that's unwarranted, warranted? How do you feel about the data from China?
I don't understand how the Chinese data is mathematically possible. And what I mean by that is, let's assume this has an R-naught value of 3 or 4, which most experts say it's right around there. Okay, so that means that every one person that gets it spreads it to another four people. That's how you get the exponential growth. And we know, or we can assume, that the only way that you beat this is if you get herd immunity or a vaccine. It's basically the same thing. Well, if we had to get to 60% of the population, or if China had to get to 60% of the population, let's just say they have a billion people, and I know they have more than that, but just a billion to make the numbers easy. So that's 600 million people that would have to get it before it would start to diffuse itself. So I don't think 80,000 is that close to 600 million. And if they are going back to work and doing all these things, how are they just instantly stopping the spread? It doesn't – I think people see this as something as though you just make everyone stay at home for a couple weeks, and those people that are sick, they get better, and then everyone just goes back to work, and you're good to go.
Right. Which
That's
is
not
what
how
happens.
This works.
Right.
It's not how this works. It has to work its way through the system. So if China went back to work, then and let's say the longer they're back to work, the higher the probability that they get right back into a situation where they were before, where they have to go into lockdown and they go back to an exponential growth curve. So I just don't see how they keep that continually flat unless they just have everyone on lockdown. That's really the only way to do that. And since they're not in lockdown, then I just don't think you can believe those numbers.
Well, the math just doesn't make sense. I mean, if you just want to take – if you don't want to be a statistician and you don't want to be an epidemiologist about it and you just want to take a common sense view of China, okay? The country has 1.3 billion people. Were to believe that the virus originated in Wuhan, okay? We saw the measures that China took when it came to quarantining and how draconian and aggressive they were. But as you said, given the population density, are we really to believe that China topped out at 80-something infections? Does that make sense?
Well, they can't top out at 80. That's my whole point. That's not possible. So you can only top out at 600 million or have a vaccine. That's it. Those are your only two options. So they're not at 600 million yet. So therefore, 80,000 is incorrect.
So what you're saying is there's no way for them to just stop the virus from spreading.
No, there is. That's not possible unless you just – everyone is in a bubble and they don't leave. Like they don't leave their apartment ever. Then yes, it would be – you would be able to do that. Or every single major scientist in the world is wrong and the R-naught value is not 3 or 4. It's less than 1 because you've done a lot of research on this. You know that that's the magic number. If you can get the R-naught value lower than 1 – that means it just works its way through the system. It doesn't spread to society fast enough to continue to grow.
Right, it dies off on its own. Yep. So then my follow-up question is, since you and I are on the same page about the data coming out of China, is what do you think the impact is, and isn't the onus on these major media corporations that, again, every article I read, George, every single one of them, down to even Elon Musk tweeting last week, no new cases out of China, and every mainstream media article out there is using these numbers as gospel, right? So, yeah, I think maybe that could be a tool that's being used to make the U.S. and Italy and all these other countries look like we're bumbling the issue more than we are, which is something that I wrote about today. But at what point does the media, George, say, we got to get real here, man? We're getting gamed. Do you think that happens eventually?
Honestly, Chris, I'm very cynical of the media. Before I retired, I had a lot of interactions with the media, and I've come to realize that, and there's some great journalists out there. I don't want to throw everyone under the bus, but between the people in the media and politicians, you're really looking at the dregs of society. I mean, it's the bottom of the barrel as far as the integrity, ethics, morality. But I think that the media is going to do whatever they think they need to do to generate the most eyeballs, right? So if you're an MSNBC, whatever the left narrative is, you're going to push that as much as possible because that's what's going to bring in more eyeballs. If you're a Fox and you're more on the right, then you're going to pick up on whatever that narrative is. And if you're an Elon Musk, you're going to look at whatever's best for the price of your stock. And that's going to be the narrative that you're going to try to push. So I think that's where you got to start. You got to start by following the money and then asking yourself, how is that affecting how they're presenting this or their decision-making process with what they decide to present and how they decide to present those facts. I mean, listen, the way the media works, especially the news and CNN and a lot of these news shows, just for your viewers who might not know this, they don't report the news. They do not report the news. I know this definitively. They create the news. So what happens at the beginning of the week or every single morning is the employees, the journalists, the writers, everyone, they'll get together and they'll say, okay, what's going to get us the most eyeballs? Okay, well, a story on how China's numbers are going down, that's going to get us the most eyeballs. So then they just collect facts. They cherry pick and they'll collect facts to do it, to build a story around that narrative. Whether that's true or not, that's not the point. That's completely irrelevant. And I want to make sure that I'm clear. It's not just the CNNs that are doing that or the MSNBCs. It's the Fox. It's every single one of them based on what target market they're trying to cater to.
Yeah. Doesn't it alarm you when you think about that? What I was thinking about this morning, which is the Chinese numbers are essentially the basis, the foundation of the world's information on the coronavirus. They're the basis down, and it's not just the infection numbers. It's them providing other countries with, their scientific data about the virus and the genetic sequencing and all this other shit. When you think... Go ahead.
Well, you're in the thick of things more than I am as far as the American media. I'm completely removed from that just being down here. And I love that, by the way. That's one of the benefits of being down here. But I look at the Italian data or what's going on there or what's going on in Spain, and I was under the impression that the media would focus on Italy and Spain and what's going on with Europe just as much as China. But it sounds like what you're telling me is the mainstream media is just really honing in on China because they say they were able to flatten the curve and just kind of ignoring Spain and Italy as though they're just anomalies. Is that
what
you're saying?
Well, what's happening right now, and one of the things that inspired me to write this morning, is that the U.S. is being kind of shamed into by the media. The New York Times specifically put out an article, said, hey, we're a lot of missteps here in the U.S. and that's why, our numbers look so terrible comparatively to China. And I don't disagree that there have been missteps in the U.S. But for all of the media to use China as the litmus test to compare themselves against, and also then to watch China and the Global Times, which is, the Chinese state's mouthpiece, go on Twitter and start to kind of push the narrative of, hey, we got this shit under control, but Italy's really fucking it up. The U.S. is really fucking it up. Hey, by the way, we have things so under control here that we're donating supplies to Iran and we're donating supplies to the Czech Republic. By the way, testing kits that are coming back with 80% of them not working. You know, it's. I think it's all about optics for China. So for them to be able to turn around and change the narrative and say, oh, well, we got it under control. We don't know what the rest of the fucking world is doing. You guys obviously have dropped the ball. They're only allowed to do that. China's only allowed to do that if the rest of the world takes them on their word about the data and not the other alternative media accounts, social media accounts, you know, other data, supplemental data, cell phone data that says that suggests that China's numbers could be significantly underreported. That's what enables them to be able to change the narrative like that. And I just find that exceptionally concerning. And I feel like the media is getting duped and then in turn is turning around and duping the public.
I get what you're saying now, and I totally agree. I think that the U.S. did drop the ball with the testing and whatnot. And I totally think that that's the wrong move for the media to use China as a benchmark,
right?
As though this is pristine data. But the one thing I want to mention on that, Chris, do we expect anything else? I mean, look at even the data in the United States. The media looks at the CPI as though it's gospel,
right?
They look at the jobs numbers as though it's gospel. And a month later, they just revise it. And when they revise it, the market doesn't care. The only thing they care about is just that leading headline the day that it comes out. I mean, it boggles my mind all the statistics that come from the government and from the Federal Reserve that the media just reports as though it's written in stone, and that if you question the validity of the data, then you're just some tinfoil hatter. Right? Well, even if it doesn't even make sense, and even if they revise it down the road, and it just goes back to the bull market and people just remembering what they want to remember, like we were saying earlier, and that they get this, we'll go back to the jobs numbers, use that, or even GDP. And they'll say, yep, this was the GDP, or yep, look at this. We've got inflation low. CPI's only at 2%. And then as long as we're in a bull market, the MO is to just take that headline number, as long as it's good, and then if it's revised down, then we kind of completely ignore that. It's just that recency bias. But, you know, where I really get frustrated, let's say, to say the least, is like with the CPI and the way GDP is measured. This is completely ridiculous. When you look at the and I'm talking about real GDP, so you've got to adjust for inflation, but then it all depends on, okay, well, what number are you using for inflation? So if you're using the CPI, okay, well, that takes – let's say that nominal GDP is running at 4% and the CPI is 2%. Okay, you bring it down to 2%, then your real GDP, 2% growth, right? And then everyone takes that as though, yep, that's it. The United States is growing 2%. But they never even ask themselves, okay, well, the number they're using for inflation, A, is it CPI? And if it is the CPI, is it incorrect? Is it understating things? And oh, wait, if it's understating things, then wouldn't that overstate real GDP? And then you start to dig a little bit deeper and you see that they don't use the CPI. They actually use something called the GDP deflator. And then you say, okay, well, I wonder what the GDP deflator is compared to actual CPI. And then you see that it understates inflation even more than the CPI does. And then it's compounded. So if you lay this out on a chart, you see that But if even if we use CPI, which most people would say is understated, we still only have very, very minimal real GDP growth. And then if CPI is overstated, then we have negative real growth going all the way back to, you know, the last decade when we've supposedly have been in this huge boom in the economy, and we've been in the best economy of all time according to Trump's Twitter feed. So I know that was a rant, but my point is that any of the data that the media uses as gospel, half of it's just complete garbage.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, and I want to go into that in a second. I also just want to ask, do you see any silver linings when it just comes to the virus, X the economy, right? So before we get into the economic impact, which I do want to talk about.
I keep going off on an economic
tangent. No, do it, man. Do it, brother. Listen, I came on your show a couple days ago and just screamed for an hour without stopping, and you just let me scream about whatever I wanted. So I want you to talk about whatever you want, but I want to just circle this last square when we're just talking about the virus X the economy and ask you if you see any, do you see any tailwinds at all? Do you see any silver linings? And I'm asking about, you know, maybe things like the fatality rate coming down as a result of more people having it that were maybe asymptomatic or mild symptoms that never got tested going into the summer, the heat, things like that. What do you see as tailwinds?
Yes, that's a great point. If we have, I think maybe 20%, I doubt we have that. But if we had like even 10%, 20% of the population that's actually had the coronavirus and not known about it, and it's had this little impact, well, although I can't say it because now it's having a massive impact on the hospital system and the healthcare system. But if it's been at this level,
some of that could be psychological though, George. You know, everybody with a cough is going to the hospital now.
That's absolutely true. Yeah. So there's a lot of moving parts. But if it's at 10 or 20% of the population and we've had just these amount of deaths or serious complications where they have to go to the hospital, then yeah, I think that could be a good thing. Well, it's definitely a good thing, but then still you got to get up to 60%. And so even if we're at 20% right now, you figure it's got to get a lot worse before it gets better, but it's not completely catastrophic as far as from a health standpoint. I just don't see a way around hundreds of thousands of people not dying. And I just really hate to say that. But let's say call it 100,000 people, unless we can somehow get a vaccine for this thing a lot faster, 3 months, 6 months, something like that. Or if we're able to quarantine the high risk people, because again, even if 20% of the Americans have had it, that still means another 40% need to have it. And then you look at how many cases we've had, but then you look at how the recovered, and you add that to the amount of people that have passed away, and there's a huge delta there, right? So how many of those people that have been tested and positive are going to fall into the category of people who have passed away? I don't know, but I think the silver lining is more economic than it is health. I hate to be negative on that, Chris.
Well, no, I want reality. I'm not asking you to be positive. I'm asking you to tell me what you think the objective truth is here and be realistic. Because, you know, listen, months ago when me and you talked about this, we were the only two people that were two of the only people that were being realists about this. And while everybody else has had these wild, dramatic swings of panic, you know, we're kind of saying the same thing we've been saying for a couple months, which is this looks like it could get out of hand. It looks like it could affect many, many millions of people. So
I think let me backtrack there, because I did think of something that I think is a silver lining. And that's if I think more Americans are taking this seriously.
Right.
I still think there's some people that aren't. But the more they see this in the media, the more they're going to take it seriously, the more they're going to, if they do go out, they're going to take precautions. They're going to practice social distancing. They're going to wear an N95 mask. They're going to do these things, which will hopefully get the R naught value down.
Right.
To call it a 1 or a 1.5, to where it's not spreading that fast, and it just buys us time to stay under the curve, to where we're not overwhelming the hospital system, and that minimizes the health impact dramatically. So I know people here in Colombia have really changed the way they operate, even before the government quarantine here, before they locked everything down. When I would just go out to get a coffee or something at a local cafe just to go, every single person in the restaurants were wearing a mask. They're wearing gloves. It looked a lot like Asia. So that's great. And if they're able to do that and just buy us time, I think that's the best we can hope for. And hopefully Americans are waking up to that reality.
Yeah, I agree with you. Certainly the point at which I was most personally concerned, and I'm not going to say panicked, because I didn't feel panicked, but I did feel a very strong sense of urgency. I was way more concerned in like late January, early February, that this tidal wave, was it you that said that yesterday or a couple days ago we were talking about, that this tidal wave was coming? Somebody said that. And it was going to splash down on the American public, and there would be a lot of fear, and there would be a lot of panic, and there would be a lot of, you know, just general upending of people's lives without warning. I mean, I feel like we saw that coming from a while away, and I was far more concerned about that than the virus. I mean, coming from China, I was worried the virus may be more fatal than they had let on. But at this point, people outside of China have had the opportunity to examine it. So I've backed off that a little bit. And my worry at the time was, man, this is going to hit the economy and this is going to hit the American public like a ton of bricks. And that's one of the things that, you know, me and you talked about on your podcast and on mine. And one of the things that we, you know, often that I was tweeting about. And now that has happened, and we're really, I said to my father last night on the phone, we're in the thick of it. Things kind of suck now, and they're going to suck for a little while. But the good part is, like, we're in that phase where things blow. And, you know, there's that old saying, if you're going through hell, keep going, right? And that's kind of where we're heading. We're heading into the fucking abyss now, and the only way to get out the other end is to go directly through it, and that's what we're doing. I almost feel calmer now, George, that initial kind of shock has worn off, because things have changed. I don't want to say worn off, but things have changed, but I think we're, as a society, moving towards normalizing this a little bit, you know, mentally. And I think what you just said about that being a tailwind, and I've said on my Twitter and elsewhere, I think a great thing is everybody in the world is working on the same problem right now, right? So awareness is at 100% at this point. And I agree with you that that's a tailwind.
Yeah, for sure. And another thing we have to remember is we have more scientists living today than we've had if combined throughout human history. So we've got some top shelf intellect working on this, hopefully, not only in the United States, but around the world. And I was speaking to, former Wall Street guy yesterday about some investing stuff, and he's got some really interesting ideas for this environment. But he pointed out a great way to look at it. He said, George, it's like being in a car accident. And for those few split seconds that you're going through that, you're thinking about nothing but survival. You're grabbing the wheel. You're not thinking about what you're going to have for dinner that night. You're not thinking about any other of your problems or any good stuff that's going. All you're thinking about is surviving the car crash. He goes, that's where we are right now. So I think that's a good thing from the standpoint of taking every country, hopefully, is coming together and saying, listen, we need to combine our resources and the manpower that we have, the intellect we have, and channel 100% of it into solving this problem. And if they do that, hopefully, while a vaccine would normally take 12 months, hopefully we can shorten it down to call it 6 months.
Right.
And then, bam, you're not off to the races, because if you're just tuning into the podcast right now, make sure you go back and listen to the first hour, because it still changes society. But from a health standpoint, where it's really a 100 times better than it would be otherwise. So I think that's something that we should all pray for.
Yeah, and outside of the scientific community, so I think you're 100% right. We have 100% of the smartest people in the world and 100% of the world's supercomputers, you know, all focused directly. And that's a lot of fucking horsepower, man.
Yeah, exactly.
That is a lot of horsepower. But also in addition to that, another thing I said last night to my mother when I was talking to her on the phone was, people outside of the scientific community, George, also have a very vested interest in doing whatever they need to do to help couch this blow. Now, whether it's an altruistic motivation on their part and they're just humanitarians, or it's a capitalistic motivation on their part. You know, there's a guy at your local 7-Eleven right now, and his regional director and that guy's regional manager and their senior VP above them, all the way up to the CEO of 7-Eleven, okay, the place you go get your coffee and your muffin right in the morning. All yeah. they're thinking about is, what can we do to help this process along? What can we do to yeah. keep people safe? And what can we do? So everybody in every business, not just scientists, are all collectively trying to push, you know, the human race to a solution. I actually joked with my mother. I said, arguably, this may be the best time to go travel, because nobody is wiping down surfaces more than now. Nobody's in the air. Nobody's flying. I mean, if you want to think like a contrarian, right? We were 6 to 8 weeks ahead of this when it happened. And now looking forward, you know, you can't help but think, like, now we're taking all the precautions we needed to take 2 months ago. Like, why the hell wouldn't you hop on a flight now and go travel?
It's like flying private. You got the whole plane to yourself.
The ticket's cheap. You got the plane to yourself. They're probably the first time the planes have been cleaned in, you know, a decade.
Right.
Every surface everywhere, from your house, from the time you leave your house to the time you get in the air to the time you land, every surface has been wiped down extensively, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I think that's a fantastic point. I mean, we're all on the same team right now. It doesn't matter whether you're on the left, the right, you're Chinese, you're Italian, you're American, you're South American, whatever. We are all on the same team trying to – whatever differences we had 30 days ago, okay, yes, some people may still be clinging on to those differences. But trust me, in a month or two, when this really hits its apex – They're going to forget that, and they're going to be focused on the problem at hand, just like Chris said with that car accident analogy. And I think that's great. I mean, we were getting – and you know this better than I do, because I spend most of my time outside the United States, and mostly for this reason. It's just getting – or it was just getting insane in the United States with the political correct garbage and the – I mean, give me a break. I just got to the point where I could not take it anymore, Chris. And so hopefully if there is another silver lining, it's people have kind of maybe realized that, okay, so, granted, your personal pronouns are important, but maybe they're not as important as I was making them out to be, right? Maybe there's other things in life, such as the economy and having a job and a roof over your head. Maybe that is a little more important right now. And hopefully this will help people focus in on what actually is important and forget the things that are kind of just trivial.
And you have to wonder whether or not we would have been so blindsided by this if we hadn't spent the last decade feeling so comfortable, not only because of the central banks, but also because of this ongoing effort to make every person feel special, like you're talking about. Everybody's got to feel comfortable all the time, which, by the way, in the markets and in nature is not normal. So you have to wonder as the market...
It's not healthy either. It's not healthy.
No, and as the market pulls back to a probably more aggressive degree than it would if we weren't didn't have this enormous bubble, you have to think the human reaction is also going to be that much more sharp and impactful on people because of the nature of kind of the social environment out there, right? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it goes back to the fourth turning stuff. I think it was Neil Howe, I believe is the gentleman's name. And I have not read that book, but I've heard a lot about it just through other podcasts like Macro Voices and the Real Vision guys. And I totally agree with you that if a situation, a pandemic or a recession or a stock market crash, it can have different psychological impacts on society based on other factors. Like what's the general attitude of the society at that time? And I think that, I mean, you talked about society just being a participation trophy type of in participation trophy mode, if you want to call it that. And I think our entire economy, I think corporate America was and is in participation trophy mode. And unfortunately, it may be even more so on a moving forward basis with all the bailouts and the Fed or the government potentially taking over the means of production through buying all the assets of the S&P or 51% of them. So, I'm getting off on the economic tangent again. So
well, let's go
back to the.
Let's go there
because I can't help myself. Damn it, gee.
No, let's go there because a moment ago you said, "Hey, everybody's only focused on the headlines." You were talking about the job number. You're talking about, hey, that front leading indicator. No matter what the underlying formula is to make it up, no matter how they revise it going forward, it's that one front leading macro indicator that immediately, bang, people see it, the algorithms see it, people trade on it, and that's it, and it's reported all over as gospel again, no matter how it is comprised and what the formula is. Now, my question to you is this. It seems to me that in the world of the stock market and in the world of the Fed and in the world of central banking, the indicator that they care about, the only one that they care about, the Fed's single mandate is the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 Index and where those numbers are. And they will do anything that they need to do to make sure if they got to buy the bond market, if they got to buy 100% of all S&P companies to make that number go where they want it to go. Tell me about your thoughts on that, and then we'll go into the stimulus and everything else.
Yeah, well, I always say in my videos that the economy, the American economy, is built on three things, and that's asset prices or asset bubbles, debt, and confidence. And I think the Fed knows that better than I do. So their number one mandate, if you ask me, is to maintain confidence. And I think because the economy has been so financialized, the only way to do that is to keep the stock market as high as as they can get it. And that's the, whether it's the Dow, the S&P, it doesn't matter. And because the average American looks at the stock market as a direct reflection of what's going on in the economy, and Trump knows that well. That's why he always, tweets about it. And you can't, if the stock market's up, he's taking full credit and doing all these things, because he understands that the average guy on the street or gal looks at the stock market, just sees a headline that the stock market's at all-time highs. And they're like, oh my gosh, wow, the U.S. economy just must be doing awesome. You know, since it's doing so great and I feel good about my job, I'm going to go to the movies tonight where I otherwise wouldn't have done that. And then you have this Keynesian type of approach where one man's spending is another man's income. And I don't dispute that that's true. It's obviously true. It's just that we tend to look at the supply side first and then the demand equation. But they are just strictly looking at the demand side of it. And they say, okay, well, what can we do to get Joe off his couch and go down to the movie theater to buy, to take out that 10-year loan for $100,000 to buy a new Ford pickup truck that depreciates 60% once they drive it off the lot? And the way you do that is to keep the stock market high. So I think that's the rationale there. Also, too, if you try to put yourself into the mindset of a Keynesian, it's all about spending, as you know, all 100% about spending, to the point where right. They think a dime of savings is an atrocity. So if you've got the majority of the baby boomers, if their net worth, in other words, their future purchasing power, is almost entirely tied up in either their house, the equity, or their 401k in the stock market. And if you have the 401k go down by 50% and you have the housing market or their equity go down by 50%, and this is someone that's 70 years old, how do you recover from that? And what, do you think you just dollar cost average on the way down? No way. You think you buy the bottom and just wait another 20 years potentially for the market to go back up or rebound, especially after you've gotten hammered in 2020, you get smoked in 2008, and in 2000, you get your ass handed to you. So you build up this this fear factor, right? You're like a beaten puppy dog in the corner. And if you're that 70-year-old guy or gal, you're like, screw this. I don't want anything to do with the stock market. It's a rigged game. It's nothing but a giant casino. Even if I've taken a 50% haircut, I'm going to take my money, I'm going to take it out of the market. I'm just going to put it into cash. And instead of having a decent lifestyle and maintaining a standard of living, I'm just going to ratchet that down and just be okay with the fact that I'm going to be poor for literally the rest of my life. And if you're looking at that from a Krugman standpoint, you're saying we cannot have that happen. The biggest glut of our population, I'm assuming it's the baby boomers. It might be the millennials. I'm not sure. But assuming it's the baby boomers, then you can't have 50% of their purchasing power just evaporate over the next 20 years. Right. So I think that's where the Fed is coming from. And that's what their motivation is. Another completely separate question is whether or not they can achieve the objective. And I don't know if you want to go into that now, or I'll let you guide the conversation.
Go ahead. Tell me about the objective.
Yeah. So the Fed has had a put for Greenspan, right? I mean, I assume that would go back to 87.
Explain to people that don't know what a put is, what you're talking about.
That's just basically the market has known that the Fed is going to have their back. They're going to do everything they can to backstop the market. So if the market goes down into bear market territory, or even less, the Fed is going to step in and say, okay, we're doing another round of quantitative easing. We're going to do whatever, Operation Twist. We're going to set up the primary dealer credit facility. We're going to set up my favorite, which I've been talking about on all my videos, which is the LF, which I affectionately call MILF. And I was making fun of the Fed. I'm like, listen, you got 900 PhDs and you can't figure out a better acronym than something that sounds like MILF. I mean, how out of touch are you with the general population? But my point is they are doing all of these programs to try to make sure that the market doesn't go down. And if it does, they're coming right in. They're trying to talk up the market. They're trying to print money to drive the market back up. And it's worked for the last, 30 years or so. And Greenspan done it. They've all done it. Bernanke, Yellen. Now, of course, Powell's doing the exact same thing. But what happened a week ago? The Fed came out with the ultimate round of bazookas. They said, we're going to do $700 billion in quantitative easing. And to put things into perspective, that is way more than any other round of quantitative easing that they have that they've done in the past or that they admit to doing in the past. And in addition to that, we're going to do $125 billion a day in quantitative easing, like we said before. So generally, in the past, once they announced any type of quantitative easing, even if it was something a lot less, the market would just skyrocket. The market would just, you're off to the races right there, because they knew that those reserves the Fed was creating was going to somehow get into the financial economy and get into asset prices. And then it's not about fundamentals, it's just about liquidity. So what happened the other week is the Fed came out with every single four-letter solution, acronym, alphabet soup. They came out with limitless quantitative easing. Their words, not mine. I think it was open-ended is the way they said it specifically. They came out with $1 trillion a day in repo commitments. All of these things. And what happened? The market goes up for, 20 minutes? An hour? And then completely tanks, just falls out of bed. So you could come to the conclusion that the Fed put has officially expired. If there is no longer a Fed put, meaning they can't prop up the market with money printing, and the market's all of a sudden on its own, with the market cap to GDP still being 120%, with the CAPE ratio still being at 23%, with a global pandemic, where does that put the stock market? What's going to prop it up now? And then the government comes out with their fiscal stimulus, which is basically another Fed put, and they're trying to prop up the market, and that seems to work a little bit better. At least the market goes up, 3 days in a row? I mean, it really skyrockets. But even after that, the rumor, sell the fact, is the saying. So they bought the rumor, and then as soon as the deal's done officially, then the market tanks by 900 points or 1,000 points. So what's next? If there's no Fed put, if there's no government put, then what is driving stock prices? And you say, well, we'll just go back to investors buying. No, people don't understand. If you go back to 2010, the only net buyer in the market was corporations buying their shares back. Not the only, but the majority, right? So that's your majority buyer in the market. Well, now look at what's going on with these bailouts. They have all these stipulations where corporations aren't going to be able to buy their shares back, or it's going to be limited, right? And I put this out on Twitter probably a week and a half ago, or maybe 2 weeks ago, where I said, before this bailout stimulus even was in the news, and I said, in my opinion, there is going to be so much blowback from the public about these bailouts. They're either going to eliminate them or they're going to limit them on a moving forward basis. And everyone on Twitter told me that I was crazy. And sure enough, when you come out with this bill, you've got all this verbiage that implies that. And I'm not saying that's a good or bad thing. I'm saying that people aren't thinking it through, because you have all these people with 401ks and with money in the market, and they're saying, yeah, if Boeing's going to take a bailout, they need to limit the buybacks and they need to do this. And I think you should let them go bust. I don't think we should even be worried about setting up rules for buybacks. I think there should be zero bailouts. You should let the free market do its job. But people aren't understanding that, yes, okay, fine, you can limit those buybacks, but if you do, what is that going to do to your 401k over the next 10 years if the main buyer in the stock market is gone? And then you could extrapolate that further into the corporate bond market, where the major buyer there has been pension funds. And that's kind of an economic silver lining, in the sense that they'll most likely be bailed out, which they're going to have to be bailed out. And if they wouldn't have, they would have blown up, and then your major buyer in the corporate bond market would have been gone.
In other words, pension liabilities that have been outstanding for a while, that pensions have been trying to play catch up on by this carry trade of many of them issuing debt and then trying to invest in the equity market, you think that they're going to get bailed out not only on the losses incurred from the market crashing here, but also in the previous liabilities that they had accrued? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, what they were doing is they were taking – they have to have 7% return right. to meet their liabilities. And so if you have ZIRP for 10 years in a row or 8 years, whatever, and you have extremely low interest rates, they can't get that yield. The only way they can do it is go further out the risk curve and take leverage. So what they do is they lever up. They go into the corporate bond market. The corporate bond market takes that cheap money, and then they just buy their shares back. Right? So your buyer in the corporate bond market essentially are the pension funds. And the buyer in the stock market are the corporations using that pension fund money, all right? So, but what I am saying, as far as the government, I think they're not only going to bail out the pension funds. I think it's going back to this attitude of, we can't feel an ounce of pain. No one can. Society can't. College students can't. It's like, we need a safe space, not only for colleges, but now we need a safe space for corporations and pension funds and everything else. So I think the government is going to bail out the pension funds. I think they're going to bail out the states. I think they're going to bail out corporations. And I think they're going to do MMT. They're going to do helicopter money. And where that's going to leave us when everything is said and done is the government or the Fed. I mean, I kind of see them almost as one, but the centralized power is going to have much more of a say and an impact on everyday life through corporate America, and potentially even through mid and small sized businesses, depending on how involved they get with issuing these bailouts and how much equity or debt they're taking on of not only corporate America, but just most businesses in general. You could have this situation where we inadvertently go social. We inadvertently go Bernie Sanders and AOC just because of the coronavirus and what the Fed and government do to try to protect, quote unquote, the economy. So moving forward, how do you not turn into a Japan? And I'm not saying from a deflationary standpoint, I'm just saying from an economic growth standpoint. You know as well as I do, the government can't run anything, and anything they touch is going to be extraordinarily inefficient, especially if we go back, and I hope we don't, but to this politically correct and all this nonsense where they're not looking at someone's merit, like on a board of directors, let's say. They're just saying, well, you have to have this type of people. If you have to have this many purple people on your board, or you have to have this many aliens, or whatever they come up with, who knows, it changes on a daily basis. But instead of looking at how good someone is at their job, they're just specifically looking at these other characteristics. And think of all the regulations that are going to come down the pipeline, like Dodd-Frank And I'm not saying that that on net balance was good or bad, but the bottom line is if the government or the Fed owns 50 or 51% of all these corporations and businesses, the economic growth is going to be just completely halted at best if we don't go in reverse. And that's with no coronavirus whatsoever. That's if it's in totally in the rear view mirror. I don't know. Hopefully I'm seeing it wrong. What do you think?
Well, and they're so intent on bailing people out. One of the things I took exception with that I tweeted about a couple weeks ago was the fact that any bailout for Boeing isn't just going to bail them out of the coronavirus issue. It's going to bail them out of this legacy issue that they've been having with the 737 MAX. So Boeing has been in huge trouble for the last several months because of, you know, they're prioritizing getting this plane done and out there to compete with Airbus and then, you know, cutting corners, which resulted in tangible, real world negatives. Many people died, hundreds of people died, and the company was being punished for that, and they were being put in a precarious position, not only from a PR standpoint, but also from an economic standpoint, and that's what they deserve for what they did. Now, they're going to get bailed out of that problem too, which has nothing to do with coronavirus. And the government is so intent on bailing them out that Trump is still out there saying, oh, we got to protect Boeing, even after the company came out last week and said, hey, by the way, government, if you're thinking about an equity stake in the company to bail us out, forget it. We're not interested. And instead of the government saying, hey, go fungul, go throw rocks, right? Trump's still out there saying, we got to protect Boeing. We got to, you know, and I think a lot of this too, as we said when I was on your show, was built on the perception that a company going bankrupt means that it's, you know, it just disappears. The American Airlines planes just disappear from the runway and Boeing just never makes a plane again. When all it is, you know, a restructuring of debt. So I agree with you that they're hell-bent on just bailing everybody out.
Yeah, which is what we need. We need a restructuring of debt. We've got way too much debt in not only corporate America, but on the consumer balance sheet, on the state's balance sheet. Everywhere you look, we've got too much debt. That's what we need, is we need a restructuring of debt. We're just trying to get in the way of the system becoming healthy again.
Right, correcting itself.
Correct. That's right. That's right. I mean, let's look at the economic impact of the coronavirus for a moment. If the government would just sit and do nothing, which is what they should do, and just let the market clear, think of all the malinvestment we've had over the last, decades and decades. And most people don't realize, or they just don't think it through, that interest rates are the price of money. And money is one half of every single transaction. We all know how important price discovery is. So if the Fed has manipulated interest rates for the last 20 years, well, then they've manipulated the price of everything, right? So how do you know how much a can of Coke really is? How much do you know? How much is a Boeing stock worth? How much is your Ford pickup truck worth? You don't know. How much is your house worth? Because we haven't had market prices since the Fed has come in and tried to manhandle interest rates. Because you look at the price of everything. Well, what would the price of a can of Coke be if interest rates were 12%? It'd probably be different. So we haven't had any price discovery. And the one thing that would have been good about the coronavirus is it would have flushed all that debt out of the system. We would have seen market interest rates. We would have gone through some massive pain. I mean, almost unbearable type of pain. But we would have come out the other side. And we would now have a free market economy. All of the bad actors that bought all the share buybacks, that levered up, that borrowed all the pension fund money to just basically buy their own shares back, so put the money in their own back pocket, and just total disregard for the future of their own companies. All of these bad actors, not only in corporate America, but on the consumer side, everywhere, they would have been completely gone, and you would have had people come in that were competent, that made good, prudent decisions. And why? Because they've got the capital to take over the businesses. They come in, restructure everything, and then it's just like the whole entire economy goes through a Chapter 11. And then once you go through that, you're out the other side, you've got a clean balance sheet, you've got free market capitalism, you've got actual real interest rates, you've got price discovery, and then we're off to the races.
Yeah, fucking A right. But, you know, that's not going to happen, unfortunately. But
yeah.
I know, right? The old Price is Right.
That was my dream, Chris. You just ruined it.
The Price is Right horn. Da, 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 da. But, you know, listen, for the outside listener, all right, maybe somebody that doesn't understand most of what we're talking about, here's the question I want to ask you. I saw this in a Zero Hedge article, I think, earlier today. And I want to try to explain, or I want you to, I don't want to do it. I want you to try to explain kind of what the beef is here with what we're doing. And this is what I mean. My mother said to me on the phone yesterday, "Do you think that this is going to lead us into a depression?" And my answer was, I think we're already in a depression. I think that what the Fed has done here with printing all of this money and all of this fiscal stimulus right now is we're changing the tire on a car that's going 90 miles an hour down the highway. And the Fed has taken the one tire off, which was our economy, and replaced their tire, which is their fake economy that comes in the form of just money that they've created out of thin air. Okay, so that's going to hold us over and we're going to keep cruising down the highway. But for people that don't really understand why we take exception with the potential moral hazard, the question I want to ask you is, if the Fed can print $3 trillion, why can't it just print $350 trillion and then everybody would be a millionaire, George? Why can't we just do that? And then we could print all this money and we could collectively, you know, raise everybody up out of poverty together and we'd all be millionaires. Explain why that doesn't work and then talk about the slippery slope that we're on.
Okay. Let's start with why that won't work as far as just giving everyone $1 trillion. You've got just simply more money chasing the same amount of goods and services. It's just really that simple. If you had an economy, let's just say you and I are the only producers in an economy. You grow corn and I grow soybeans, right? Well, if there's only $2 in our economy and we just trade those dollars back and forth because I need to buy what you have and you need to buy what I have, and if we create another $2, so we have $4, that doesn't make either of us any richer, right? It just means that instead of giving you $1 for your stuff, I give you $2 for your stuff, and you give me $2. So we really don't have any more, at the end of the day, we don't have any more purchasing power. Now, if the amount of goods and services increased at the same rate, now that's a good thing. Now you're good to go because you have more stuff competing for more currency units.
But I mean, okay, like now, if everything stayed the same and we just dropped everybody $1 million, why wouldn't that work?
Well, it's just pure inflation. So you're not going to have any more purchasing power. The people that get the money first, they will have additional purchasing power. But once it works its way through the system, you're actually on net balance, you're going to be decreasing purchasing power because the people, all the prices are going up, but the people who have savings, their purchasing power goes down. by pretty much the same rate, if not more, than the people who get the money in the first place. So once it works its way through the system, you don't have any benefit at all. In fact, it's a draw on society. But also, I'd like to point out, going back to that just very simple equation where you've got X amount of currency units chasing X amount of goods and services, what have we heard in the media lately? A real draw, and we had this prior to the coronavirus, but now it's really, really, they're shouting it from the mountaintops. That is deglobalization. Okay. Well, maybe it's good that we don't produce our face masks in China and our ventilators or our car parts, or you just fill in the blank. Well, if all that stuff is now made in the United States, okay, well, we're taking it from a low-wage country and bringing it into a high-wage type of country. So what does that do to your input costs? Well, that raises your input costs. Okay, so let's say you're raising the input costs of goods and services while at the same time you're increasing the money supply and you're cutting off your supply chains that took decades to set up, and you're trying to build those same supply chains in the United States. That's not going to happen overnight. You're not going to just wave a magic wand and build a factory that produces XYZ widget. So what you're doing at the same time, you're increasing the money supply. And I'm not talking about taking it from, let's call it 20 trillion in M2 up to 22 trillion. I'm talking about taking it to 40 trillion, 50 trillion, which is extremely realistic based on what the Fed's doing. And
based on what happened last week alone.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds insane to say those numbers, but hey, that's most likely where we're going. So you've got all – let's say you double the money supply in whatever, 6 months or a year, while at the same time you are increasing your input costs and – you're decreasing the amount of goods and services because of deglobalization and us trying to build those supply chains inside the United States that take, call it, 10 years to set up. So you get into this situation where you have even more inflation than you otherwise would 30 days ago. Right, even with them taking the money supply up and doubling it, because you have the supply going down at the same time that all the money supply is just going through the roof. So I hope that answers your question. It's on net balance, it's really, really bad.
So what's the inflection point? I mean, how much can we print before we cause a huge problem? Right? If we can print $3 trillion, can we print 6? Can we print 60? Can we print 120? I mean, what can we do and what can't we do? And why is this a slippery slope?
Right. So you have to ask yourself, by printing money, what are they doing with it? So I'm trying to, it's a hell of a lot easier with a whiteboard. But since I don't have a whiteboard, when the Fed quote unquote prints money, all they're doing is creating reserves, bank reserves. That's, you've got to look at it, and I think I just said this on my last interview, if I already said it here, forgive me, but it's basically like getting tokens at Dave and Buster's. That, yeah, okay, you've got a dollar token at Dave and Buster's, but you can't really go out and just give it to the guy at the grocery store, go buy gas with it or pay your rent with it, although it still has a value of $1. That's kind of what bank reserves are that the Fed quote unquote prints. Okay, so before, it was up to the primary dealers to do something with those bank reserves that the Fed prints out of thin air to buy the assets. So the primary dealers would either buy financial assets or they would create more liabilities in the banking system. What are liabilities? They're deposits. Okay, so if those reserves, the only way for them to get out into the real economy is by the primary dealers or banks under the Fed's umbrella by actually doing something to create more deposits in the retail banking system. Okay, so the Fed could print a quadrillion dollars, and as long as they're Dave and Buster tokens, and they're basically under their mattress, then it's not going to get out in the real system. It doesn't matter. It's not going to create price inflation, especially if the only thing the primary dealers are using those Dave and Buster tokens for is to lend to hedge funds that are going into the stock market or buying corporate debt. Then it's just staying in the financial system. So it doesn't matter. You're not going to see just massive price inflation. Now, I would argue that we have had quite a bit of price inflation in the real economy, but nowhere near as much as we would if the $4.5 trillion that the Fed printed over since 2008 had actually gone directly into the quote-unquote real economy. So now what they're doing is different. Okay, now the government is spending the money, and the Fed's going to monetize the debt, meaning they're basically buying it from the government. That's going to create those bank deposits in the real economy. It's going to circulate. It's going to create velocity. And it's going to be chasing goods and services that you buy on a daily basis instead of chasing stocks or chasing corporate debt. So whenever you look at inflation or the dollar going to zero or the dollar going down or the dollar going up, you have to ask yourself, compared to what? So if you ask me, George, are you a dollar bull or a bear? I'd say, well, I'm in relationship to what you buy at the grocery store, I'm going to be a dollar bear. Okay. Compared to the stock market, I'm going to be a dollar bull. Or compared to the euro, maybe a dollar bull, right? So you first and foremost, you have to understand what type of money is being created. And then you have to ask yourself, is it getting into the system in the form of deposits? And if it is, what type of goods and services is it chasing? And are we going to have an increase of those goods and services or a decrease of those goods and services?
Lest we forget that the inflation that is measured via the CPI has already, and this is just the inflation that we've incurred over the last decade, let's say, like you said, has already, you know, accounted for these hedonic adjustments in efficiency and production. And also, too, you notice things like when you go to buy a bag of chips, there's not as many chips as there were in there. But hey, if the price of a bag of chips doesn't move, well, then there's no inflation. But it's like, all right, well, how many ounces are you really getting? If you're, there's been all these little con jobs with the products. All you have to know is every consumer company everywhere is trying to give you less and charge you more at all times. So anytime that you see, you know, a change in the sizing of a product that you're being sold, I give you, for instance, that just happened an hour before I got on the podcast with you. I was at the supermarket. I went out. I had a very careful and cautious trip. I needed to get one or two items that were like absolute necessities. But also I stopped to get some M&Ms as well. And when I picked up the bag of M&Ms that they're selling, you know, you used to be able to get those in the huge, like, 5-pound bags, like in the grocery market. You would get the big fuckers, right? They would sell the normal ones in the aisle. Before there was king size, right? You would get a normal bag of M&Ms in the aisle. And then when you went to the bulk candy aisle, you'd be able to get a big ass thing of M&Ms now. Now you can get king size ones in the candy aisle, which if you look at the net weight or the net price per weight, which is one of my favorite things to look at in a supermarket, by the way. You know, the price tag always has the price then it's got the price per ounce or the price per weight. Look at that second price. That tells you a hell of a lot more than the original price. But if you look at the price per ounce on like a king size candy bar, it's way more expensive than a normal size candy bar. And if you go into the bulk aisle now, well, the big bag, the 5-pound bag, which was a full bag, full to the brim with M&Ms, the 5-pound industrial Costco fucking size bag, has now been reduced to these little stand-up you know, bags that give the appearance of looking bigger, but when you open them, they don't really have much more than the regular the king size right. that you get from the candy aisle. But they're charging you $5.49 for it or $6.49 for it. And yeah. everything that's happening to consumers everywhere is a microcosm of that example.
Absolutely.
Then you talk about adding, you know, then you talk about the velocity of the money that'll be coming into the system now. I mean, look out.
Yeah, it's goes back to the misery index, and that's what you look at with stagflation. And you've got inflation just running rampant at a time when unemployment is high, wages aren't keeping up with inflation. And I think that we could go through a stagflationary environment while at the same time when the average Joe or Jane is turning on CNBC, they're hearing that the dollar is strong.
Right.
I think that may happen. And I think that'll piss people off even more.
Well,
that every single time they turn on the TV, they see the dollar's getting stronger, 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 meaning the DXY is going up because it's just going up against a bag or a basket of currencies. But to your point, they're hearing this dollar is strong, while at the same time, every single time they go to the grocery store, their bag of M&Ms goes from $1 to $1.50 to $2 to $4 to $5. And they're just saying, what
and
the
it's
hell
got less
is going on
and
here?
Less and less product in it, you know?
Right. They're getting squeezed. That's one of the many reasons why handing out $1 million or $1 trillion to every single person in the long run just doesn't pan out, because this is exactly the type of shenanigans or the type of economy that you see. It's just the consumer being squeezed, savers being squeezed, and this environment where the only way that you can get ahead is by taking any of the crumbs that you're able to save and go as far out the risk curve as you possibly can and just gamble in hopes that the Fed inflates another kind of asset bubble. And that's where we were, in my opinion, over the last 5 years. And I think I hope we don't go that direction again, but I'm afraid that we may, especially if you start to see real wages go down. And then how are people going to improve their standard of living?
Well, they won't.
And if you have a lot more government involvement in the economy, it becomes harder to start a business. There's more regulations. There's more rules. There's more protection for employees, which I'm not saying is bad, but I think it should come as a result of the free market. It should be a bottoms-up thing and not a tops-down. But you're going to have these types, most likely, you're going to have this type of involvement in the economy. So if you're the millennial right now, or you're the 20-something or the college graduate, and you're trying to figure out, okay, well, how can I make some money? How can I retire at 40 or 50? Or how can I be in control of my own destiny? Because I don't think that Social Security is going to be there. If it is there, it's not going to have the purchasing power that I'm expecting. So I need to take care of myself. Well, how are you – like, where do you go with that? And then – I honestly, Chris, I think that's why Robinhood and all of these discount brokers that popped up with that just lets anyone just make all these trades on their phone. I think that was a result of what the Fed has done. And the fact that we've had 2,000% inflation since 1913. And if you think about what inflation does, it devalues savings. So it creates an environment where that's the only way that you can get ahead. And especially if the Fed's doing QE and the stock market's going up, while at the same time everything else is flatlining, you have this whole generation of individuals that see that their only way out is Bitcoin. Their only way out is shares of Tesla, Uber, you know, fill in the blank, right? That's the way that they're going to get ahead. I think that's a result of the Fed and the result of what they call stable prices, which makes me even more angry. And they call stable prices just prices that are going up by 2%, if not more, per year. But compounded, that's what puts the average person into a bind.
Yeah, well, you're 100% right. And there's no, you know, first off, the younger generation isn't being conditioned to save. So going back to what you said earlier, what they learn in economics courses, if they take them, or what they learn from watching CNBC, or what they learn from watching Jerome Powell talk, is that spending is what drives the economy. So there's no there's no incentive for them to save. There's only an incentive for them to spend. And there's more of an incentive for them to take on debt when they see that really there's no consequences to not repaying debt, because they always get bailed out one way or another. And ultimately, you know, I think you're right about things like Robinhood. I don't even know if the younger generation is smart enough to know where we would have looked for yield 25 years ago in, you know, CDs and savings accounts and things like that. But
I go back to the 1800s. I mean, I go back to the late 1800s when we had the...
You're very old.
Yeah, that dates me, right? But when we go back to the purest gold standard, and you had a whole entire century of deflation.
Right.
And if you just think about...
Which was a good thing.
Oh my gosh, it was amazing. It would save... It would solve almost every single major problem outside of the health problems we're having right now, but as far as economic problems, and I think a lot of the social problems as well. And if you just see that from the outside looking in, you're like, yeah, okay, whatever, George, that doesn't seem right. But if you actually dive deeper and you think about the fact that what if your savings not only made 4% per year, just in a bank account, 4%, but then we had 3% deflation.
Right.
So you're making a 7% return just on your checking account.
Right.
Every single year, while at the same time, the cost of everything that you buy is constantly going down, and at the same time, your wages are going up in nominal terms. If you look at the period between 1870 and 1900, or basically before they started the Fed, you see that we had wages going up nominally by about 1% per year, about 3% per year deflation, and we had nominal GDP growth, nominal. So when you look at it in real terms, it's fantastic. And you had interest rates of right around 4% on the 10-year. So, I mean, all you have to do is save your money, and at the end of 50 year or at the end of 30 years when you're 50 years old, that's your retirement plan.
Yeah,
you don't need the government. You don't need anything. You just let the free market create deflation and make the value of your savings go up. And that is your social security system. You don't have to rely on the government for that.
Yeah, and you're compounding like 10% in that situation, like in real terms, right? Given all of the circumstances that you just said. I mean, your purchasing power is growing. You're getting, I mean, you're making like 10% in a situation like that annually, just for being rewarded for saving your money.
And the key is saving your money. Not speculating, not gambling, not going into the stock market, not buying bonds, not buying assets, not buying financial assets. Think about, okay, let's just look at the coronavirus right now, right? If people had a lot of savings because they were incentivized to save, because that's the path to prosperity because of deflation and the free market actually working. Because let's remember that if you leave the free market up to its own devices, you will get lower and lower prices, because that's what entrepreneurs do. Every single morning they wake up and they try to figure out how they can deliver a better good or service for price. So prices naturally go down, right? So if you don't need to take that money and gamble to try to get ahead, you just save the money. And let's just say that we had a 10% savings rate. Nothing like Japan, at like 20 to 30%, but just even a 10% savings rate over the past, call it 40 years. And then that passes down from generation to generation. We forget that as well, right? That savings just grows and grows and grows and grows. Then it goes from grandfather to father to son. So it just keeps growing and growing and growing, hopefully. And then you come through with some pandemic. All right. Well, it's not that, from an economic standpoint, it's not that big a deal. People can afford to sit in their house for 2 or 3 months. Companies can afford to just shut the door for 2 or 3 months if they have to. Why? Because everyone is loaded to the hilt in savings. That's why. And it all goes back to the Federal Reserve creating inflation.
Yeah, 100%. And this discussion about companies having a rainy day fund to fall back on is exactly what you're talking about and exactly what we didn't do. You know, the companies have done what people do, which is they spend and spend and take on more and more leverage. And now we're in this completely different economic system on a completely different path. And the further down we go, the more of an unholy, you know, correction we're going to have when the market ultimately reverts back to what we're talking about, which is just, it's a foregone conclusion. The only question is when, George. I mean, when do you see that possibly happening?
I think this could, and nothing is certain. Everything is a game of probabilities, as you know well. But I think this could be it. Since the Fed has blown it, and it looks like the Fed put has expired. If the government put also has expired, then there's nothing propping out the market or propping up the market, and it's going to clear. And that's what's going to – that the market is just going to basically look at the Fed and the government and say, you know what? I'm done. It's time to pay the fiddler. And how would that play out? Well, the Fed and the government tries to fight that any way they can. So let's just say excuse me, they start the MMT and that gets the inflation genie out of the bottle. All right. Well, you know as well as I do that the economy cannot stand more than, call it, 3.5% on the 10-year. Most of your listeners, I think, will understand why, unless you want me to go into that. But that's
go
basically
ahead.
Because that's consumer debt and that's mortgages and everything. The interest rate goes up to up a lot higher in the real economy. So when people roll over their debt or have to buy a new house,
right,
then they're doing it at higher interest rates. Everything gets more expensive, and that just cripples the economy because we've now been conditioned and the economy is addicted to 0% interest rates. So you've got a threshold there. And by the way, that threshold is always coming down. It's not like it's going up. It's because we saw that 3.5 when the Fed took Fed funds to 2.25, and Jerome Powell had to say, whoops, nope, sorry, that's not gonna happen, and start to go back down. And I believe the 10-year was right about 3.5. So anything over 3.5, in my videos, I call it the no bueno zone, where you don't want to be there, and the Fed knows that. So, but my point is, if 6 months ago it was 3.5, now it's most likely 3. And if we go negative, which we are on T-bills, but if the Fed funds goes negative, then you're going to get to a point where the no bueno zone is 1%, right? And so that's where the economy gets into real trouble. Okay, so let's say they do MMT. That starts to create inflationary expectations. And remember, the long end of the yield curve, what makes yields go up isn't necessarily the inflation itself. It's the expectation of inflation. That's why whenever the Fed has increased its balance sheet in the past to buy bonds, which creates demand, that creates demand. So the more demand you have of something, you would think the price would go up. Or in the case of bonds, the yield would go down. But what's happened to treasuries, the long end, every single time the Fed has done quantitative easing? Interest rates have gone up, not down. So meaning there's, on aggregate, there's less demand than there was before the Fed printed up all the funny money to buy it in the first place, right? So my point is that it's inflationary expectations. So if the rates start to go up, well, the economy can't handle that. It'll cripple it, just ironically, like the coronavirus. You can imagine if interest rates went from, let's say, the mortgages right now are 4%. Let's just say over the span of a month, they went to 10%. Well, that looks exactly like the coronavirus from an economic standpoint, right? And it's the same thing if you look at interest rates throughout the entire economy. So the Fed can't have that. What's the only option? It's for them to peg the yield curve just like they did in World War II, right? I think Brainerd came out the other day and she was calling it yield curve control. So they do this yield curve control. Well, if the market is trying to push rates up, even when the Fed is buying more bonds,
right,
by printing more money, well, how much more money does the Fed have to print? They basically, to your point, they have to buy the entire market to peg the curve, because the market forces are trying to drive those rates up. So that creates a situation where even if we do have inflation at, call it a 5, 6, 7, it's going up to a 10% clip. Say we even get to the 1970s. The Fed still has to print even more money, to where you're exacerbating the problem. You're throwing fuel onto the fire. That's why before Volcker passed, what was it, 6 months ago or whatever, I think in an interview he was asked, listen, if you know we're at historic low interest rates, 5,000-year lows, if the economy got to a point where we saw inflation, couldn't we just do what you did back in 80-81, where you just jack rates to 18% to kill inflation? And he's like, no, you could not do that. That is impossible today. Why? Because of the amount of debt in the system. When Volcker did that back in the early 80s, the debt to GDP was like 30%. 30. So how do you jack rates to 18% or whatever they would have to jack them to in order to control inflation, when you've got sovereign debt at $23 trillion or 110% of GDP, or you've got corporate debt at all-time highs, when you have consumer debt at all-time highs? The answer is you can't. So the only release valve is the dollar. And you get this consumer price inflation that just gets out of control. It never ends. And the Fed is impotent. They can't do anything to stop it. That's when you get into a potential inflationary depression where – and Chris, what happens in inflation? It wipes out the debt. So that's the market force coming in and really demanding and forcing the Fed and the government to do what they should have done a long time ago. And that's not even create the debt in the first place, but that's like the wildfire, the forest fire,
right,
that takes out all the brush that gets us back to where we should have been a long time ago. I think that's potentially how it plays out.
Awesome. George, listen, I want to thank you so much for taking a couple hours for me. I knew I wanted to do something long form today with you because I wanted to take my time and run through these things with you, and I appreciate you being patient with me, and I know you did an interview before this, so you know, please get up, use the bathroom, go have a beer, enjoy the rest of your day. What does George Gammon drink down in Chile if he's going to have a cocktail?
Well, right now nothing, because I can't go out of the damn apartment in Colombia. Generally though,
Colombia, I said Chile, I'm thinking of Whitney.
Yeah, what they really like down here is a drink called aguardiente, and it's nasty, but man, they love it. The Colombians, they drink a lot differently than we do in the United States. They just get a bunch of people at a table, live music, they get up and dance, and they just pour shots all night long, and every single person just has their own chaser, and just every 5 minutes they pour another round of shots. It's not a whole
– Holy shit.
Yeah, that's how they kind of do it here. So, when in Rome, right?
So you'll drink that though. Is that what you drink? You have anything at the apartment now?
No, I don't. I have some. I think I've got some whiskey that someone gave me as a gift, and you know, I was just saving that because I was thinking through the other day. I'm at like 83,000 subscribers or something like that. I'm like, shoot, this is gonna kind of suck if I get 100,000, which is kind of like a milestone for a YouTuber because you get that thing from YouTube. And I'm like, if I'm gonna be quarantined and locked in my apartment, kind of sucks. But I'm like, well, maybe what I can do is a live stream and pour myself a glass of whiskey and just do a quick Q&A while I'm having a stiff drink myself. You know, that's kind of one of the lines that I use in a lot of my videos when I'm about ready to give some data that's looks really, really bad. I just forewarn the audience that it's stiff drink time. So maybe we'll have stiff drink time with a glass of whiskey on a live stream. Who knows?
And at the same time, you're giving everybody a wonderful lesson on saving. Because if you hadn't saved your whiskey, you wouldn't have it now during the pandemic when you fucking need it the most, right? So,
exactly.
George Gammon, my brother, come back soon and look forward to you posting our interview from the other day as well. Just your YouTube channel is just George Gammon, spelled out G-A-M-M-O-N, and you are at George Gammon on Twitter. You got anything else you want to pump before I call it a day?
No, that's it, Chris. I really enjoy the conversation. I can't wait to do it again. Just for all your fans and viewers and listeners, the interview that you and I did on my channel, I'll most likely post that on Tuesday evening around 8, 9 p.m. Eastern.
Awesome. Yeah. So if you want the mild-mannered, intelligent interview, you just listen to it. And if you want more of your insane, profanity-laden... you can turn into the one I did on your show. All right, thanks a lot, George. We'll speak soon, brother.
All right, thanks, buddy.
That was the man himself, George Gammon. Man, I'm so stoked that he's got so many followers. He's doing so well. He's really one of the only voices of reason left in the financial world. Check him out on YouTube. Check him out on Twitter. George Gammon, G-A-M-M-O-N. For right now, though, at this house, it is stiff drink time, motherfuckers. Happy quarantine. Let's go throw a couple more back. I am out of here. Peace.